This is Discovery from the BBC World Service. I'm Jamal Khalili, and in my series, The Life Scientific, I get to talk to some of the extraordinary men and women who are trying to understand our world and make it a better place. And my guest today has really helped to achieve that for those that suffer from migraine. I remember them myself as a young teenager, curled up in bed with my head buried in a pillow. This neurological condition is far more common than you might think. While medications to help relieve the symptoms of migraine have been around for some time, they haven't worked for everyone, and the condition was poorly understood. Fast forward to today and to my guest, Peter Goadsby, a true pioneer in the field. He is Professor of Neurology at King's College London's Institute of Psychiatry, Psychology and Neuroscience, and internationally renowned in the field of headache and migraine. Over the course of his career, he's not only unraveled what happens in the brain during a migraine attack, his work is now benefiting patients in the form of new treatments, some of which can even prevent its onset. In recognition of his outstanding work, Peter shares this year's Brain Prize, the world's largest prize for brain research, with three other scientists in the field. Professor Peter Goadsby, welcome to the Life Scientific.
Thank you.
First of all, Peter, can we clear something up? Is it migraine or migraine, or does it not matter?
Depends on your taste and what side of the Atlantic you're on. The term comes from half-sided headache, hemicrania. So if you think that you should say hemi, I suppose you could say migraine. And if you think you say hemi, you might say migraine. In general terms, on the other side of the Atlantic, migraine is more common. In the UK, migraine is more common. So long as you understand a person, I'm okay with that.
You say tomato, I say tomato and all that business. Okay, well, I'll stick with migraine because that's what I'm used to saying. So what exactly is a migraine?
It's a disorder of the way the brain deals with incoming information, how the brain perceives light or over-perceives it or sound or smells, areas of the brain that we don't even well understand that help someone concentrate, are not working in the synchronous way that they should. And that broad brain dysfunction is what produces the broad manifestations of migraine.
It's interesting, isn't it? I mean, we often do hear about visual disturbance. Is that a common symptom of migraine?
The visual disturbance that usually gets people's attention is called the migraine aura. And that occurs in about 20 to 30% of people.
Well, as I said in the introduction, I suffered from migraine during my teens. My wife, however, still gets them regularly, but she's obviously able to manage them now with medication, which we're going to come on to later. But tell me first, just how common are migraines?
About 1 billion people in the world have migraine. At its most frequent, about the age of 40, 1 in 3 adult females have migraine. It's not so common in children, about 6%, and it falls off in later life, particularly after menopause in females.
And do we know why people get migraines?
We think that's largely genetic, that you inherit the tendency to have the attack. So I like to say to people, they get it because of poor parental choice, you might say, but not much you can do about that.
We're going to talk about the reasons behind individual attacks, what causes it physiologically. Your work, Peter, has been instrumental in understanding migraine, but you only have to go back 40 years or so, and it was a very different story. What was known about migraine back then?
I'd say not very much. So migraine was, you might say, a Cinderella condition that didn't kill anyone, that was not really taken terribly seriously.
But why? I mean, given how prevalent it must have been.
Imagine the condition it occurs in women. It's worse when they menstruate. And there's some association, broadly speaking, now that we understand, with mood disorders and anxiety. So think about it. Neurology was dominated by males. And a male sees a woman who's got a problem around menstruation and appears anxious. What response do you think you're going to get 45 years ago from that?
We hear it time and time again, misogyny just embedded if men are doing the research and the thinking.
I'm not sure I want to criticise the people. I mean, it's not the right thinking. But if your thinking is all driven by what you know, then maybe you don't come to very good conclusions. I've always thought that the way to liberate the problem was to actually provide a biological basis for thinking about it. Because once you understand the biology, dismissing it becomes impossible. I mean, we used to think the Greeks were a bit crazy because they thought that the sun was dragged across the sky by some Greek god. You know, it was an okay explanation several thousand years ago. We've got a better one now, but it doesn't mean that people were silly. It just means that at some level, you have to judge things in history. Yeah. Now, I'm not trying to be an apologist for the fact that my grand was treated badly. Don't get me wrong. If you want to improve something in medicine, you get stuck into the biology, and eventually people will take notice of that.
Well, Peter, before we get stuck into the biology of migraine, let's go back to your childhood, to Australia and the suburbs of Sydney. What did you enjoy doing as a boy?
I enjoyed, as I say, I enjoyed make-believe things with my brother as I got a little bit older. I used to like reading. My parents bought us Encyclopedia Britannica, and I would go to look something up and find yourself a couple of hours later not having read the thing you started out to read, but have read just a range of other things. I think I was always interested in finding things out. I was always curious in many ways.
You say your parents bought you encyclopedias. What was school like? Did that help sort of foster your love of reading?
School was more complex. When I grew up, it was a working class area. The school had 1,000 boys, and to keep 1,000 boys in line required a certain element of discipline. In the main, the teachers were not academically inclined. They thought spending time in the library was weird. You know, you should be out in the sunshine, getting fresh air, whatever that means. So the idea of going into the library to do some sort of schoolwork was actually banned. You'd get in trouble. I did Latin, and the teacher told me that they were stopping the Latin class because Latin was the sort of thing that you would need to know if you're going to be a doctor or a lawyer. And you should be prepared for a life in a factory. And that's why the Latin class was being stopped. So it was not a particularly academic environment, not at all.
So what influence did this environment have on you?
Oh, it made me determined to be academically successful. I mean, it was like a red rag to a bull.
So was there anyone in particular who inspired you during those early years?
My mother was she had very high expectations. So she saw 99 out of 100 in a maths test as a failure because the question was, how could you get something wrong? Because maths is logical. So she was pretty demanding when it came to results.
She was herself a maths teacher, your mother.
Yeah, she was. That's right. Very rarely uttered the word congratulations. So she gave me a sense that perfection was to be aimed for and achieved from time to time.
What did you plan to do as a career after leaving school?
Oh, I wanted to be a politician. I liked mathematics. I thought economics was interesting, and I'd become sort of politically aware. In Australia at the time, you could get Hansard, you know, the record of parliamentary proceedings, delivered to you if you just wrote a letter and asked for it. They'd give it to you for free.
I mean, that must have been a lot of paper.
Yeah.
And presumably they were happy to send it to you every week or however often.
Oh, yeah. At the time, it was a law, I think, that if you asked for it, it had to be provided.
Right.
And I read quite a lot of it.
An extraordinary level of dedication for a teenager.
I didn't see it that way. It was a pleasure. Knowing things seems just like a good thing. And I thought if you're going to be a politician, you want to read this Hansard and know how they operate. I was particularly fixated on the idea that the then Treasurer of Australia didn't know any economics. I mean, it sounds arrogant, but I was just kind of being logical. To me, at 17, it struck me that if you're going to be Treasurer, you should be an expert in economics. And I just couldn't fathom why the Treasurer didn't know any economics, and certainly much less economics than I did. And so I decided I would do economics law and then become Treasurer of Australia. That was the broad career path.
You didn't become the Treasurer of Australia.
No, merciful for Australia.
So why not? What happened then?
I'd like to say I realised that I wouldn't be able to do it, but it didn't quite work out that way. When the scores came out, I didn't score perfectly.
Oh, dear.
Unsurprisingly, perhaps. And then I had a blazing row with my mother about my lack of focus and that I hadn't scored particularly well. And I said, oh, I could get into anything. And she said, you couldn't. And I said, oh, I'd get into medicine if I wanted to. And she said, no, you couldn't. And so I just changed my first choice to medicine.
You had no interest in medicine, but you wanted to prove her wrong.
I never did biology, and I just didn't know any biology.
Well, Peter Goseby, you in fact won that place, medical school at the University of South Wales, is back in 1977. So what was it like starting there?
I was horrified. I was horrified. When the results came out, they used to publish them in the Sydney Morning Herald. And my mum, I didn't mention that I'd changed. So she looked up the code for economics law and saw that I hadn't gotten into it. I was still sleeping at the time. She came in, I'll never forget it, and hit me on the head with the newspaper and said, look, you failed. You didn't get into economics law. And she was really annoyed. And I thought, oh, God, what am I going to do with my life? And I went back to sleep for a few hours, got up, got a cup of tea, and got the newspaper and had a look at this code and thought, what is this code? Because I'd forgotten what I'd done, basically. And I looked as I got into medicine. And she didn't believe me. My dad thought it was a really bad idea. And I was just thought to myself, what have I done?
So you made your way to medical school. What was it like when you started there?
Awful. Well, firstly, it took me 2 hours to get there on public transport. Most of my classmates had gone to better-to-do schools. They just came from a different background, you might say. So it was difficult. And it was hard because biology, I hadn't done that sort of thing. So I had to really get up to speed in something that I have to say at the outset, I didn't find interesting at all.
Being a medical student in that first year without the background in biology that probably would have been very helpful, what did you make of medicine?
It wasn't terribly hard because I'd come from a background where I was highly self-motivated, whereas many of the kids in the class had come from academic schools where they didn't have to be motivated from the bottom up. I took it like a job. I made sure I turned up at 8:30, went to the library until the lecture started, attended everything, was really diligent, 20 minutes for lunch and back to work. So I regarded it as a Monday to Friday, very serious pastime.
In the following year, you heard a lecture that then challenged your view on medicine entirely, didn't it?
Yeah, in the second year, Jim Lance, professor of neurology, gave a lecture about a certain neurologic problem. And as things happened, I saw a case of it 3 weeks later. And I thought to myself, neurology, that's interesting.
And this encounter was then the catalyst for a lifelong interest in neurology and the brain.
Yes.
And before you completed your medical training, you began your research on migraine, completing an undergraduate degree and then a PhD. And it was Jim Lance, again, who inspired you.
Well, again, in the third year, he gave a lecture about migraine. But I thought the explanation for migraine just didn't make any sense to me. And I went up to him in the lecture afterwards and he looked at me and said, oh, Peter, we always need good ideas. Perhaps if you'd like to come to the laboratory and do some research and help us with an idea that makes more sense to you. I think he was serious. And I thought to myself, you know, maybe. So I asked him about research and he remembered that I'd been a bit of an idiot the year before. And he told me that I should get interested in migraine and do a year Bachelor of Medical Science degree. And during the year, he said, you should stay and do a PhD.
Before we talk about where your research then took you, you still had a year of medical school to complete. You're clearly already passionate about research, but how did you feel about becoming a doctor?
I was a bit ambivalent about it. I mean, I had a mentor in Jim Lance who was the consummate neurologist who did research, and I wanted to be like him. But I didn't really look forward to doing all the general medical training that's necessary. So it was difficult.
There was some resistance along the way, I understand.
Yes, I didn't deal with some interactions probably as well as I would have dealt with them. I was rather focused on what I wanted to do. And I got a number of complaints where people would say that it was too robotic. So the professor said, I've had complaints that you don't talk to the staff enough. At the end of the day, he thought I had no good clinical skills and actually tried to get me sacked. And if it wasn't for Lance rescuing me, I would have been out of medical training at that point.
Do you think he was justified in saying that you didn't have the same social skills that maybe other members of staff expected of you?
I don't think I have a problem dealing with people, but I'm not very good at tolerating people who get ahead of themselves too much. And they made me promise that I could stay on, but if I did this training exam, after I did it, I'd go in the lab and I'd never see any more patients. And I said, sure, I agreed, because I thought making an arrangement with a fool was not really an arrangement you had to abide by. And you're right, it would have been better just not to have wound people up.
Well, you did qualify as a doctor.
I did.
And you began to train as a neurologist. Did you enjoy the interaction with the patients themselves?
I always liked sitting in outpatients, talking to people. And I think you get better with time at the conversation. I think it's a big advantage to have grown up in a poor part of Sydney. So talking to people from that kind of demographic was always really very easy because that's people I always talk to. I was only really ever irritated by entitled people.
Well, Peter, it was around this time that you came to the UK to work at what's now the National Hospital for Neurology and Neurosurgery in Queen Square. What was that time like?
was great. Jim Lance advised me to do it. He told me that I should go there and try and behave myself and get polished. There were incredible neurologists there at the time in other areas, wonderful expertise, and so it was great.
One area which was lacking in such expertise, however, was headache disorders and migraine. So after a spell in Australia, you came back to the UK permanently in 1994. Back then, migraine wasn't taken very seriously, as you said earlier. What was it like for a patient seeking help for migraine?
The diagnosis really depended on what the most senior person in the room had to say. And then the treatments were all old. Everything had side effects.
So what was the received wisdom about what caused the migraine?
Yeah, so the received wisdom was that migraine pain was because blood vessels were dilated or enlarged in the head to cause pain and then constricted, made smaller by treatments. It was not clear how any of the medicines worked. It was a very difficult period for patients.
Migraine offered, therefore, this rich field of study. However, it wasn't the blood vessels that interested you, but the nerves serving them. What made you think that the nerves might be important?
Migraine struck me as a complex problem, just listening to what patients said. Things like light sensitivity, for example. The fundamental idea was that migraine was a brain disorder, that the changes that were occurring were driven from the brain, going outwards, you might say. So it was to turn things around and think about it in terms of nerves driving the problem, not blood vessels.
And the nerve you were particularly interested in was the trigeminal nerve, I understand.
Yeah, so the trigeminal nerve is the nerve which is involved in all sensation in the front of the head, in the forehead, around the eyes, the cheeks and the jaw, and provide sensation to the covering of the brain, this thin layer, the meninges. So it's the nerve that serves pain in the head.
We're going to talk in more detail about this trigeminal nerve and how it sends signals. Just to orient ourselves, how does it do this?
Well, the trigeminal nerve, as with all nerves, use chemicals, neurotransmitters to transmit information. And in particular, the trigeminal nerve has peptides that do that, neuropeptides.
So these neuropeptides that are being released by the trigeminal nerve in the brain, what did you want to know about them?
I was interested in trying to find ways to work out what these transmitters were, with the basic idea that if you could block them, you might be able to improve migraine. I was working with a Swede, Lars Edvinson. We wanted to understand which neuropeptide was important in the trigeminal nerve in an experimental setting, and quickly ask the question, did the same thing happen in humans? So stimulating the trigeminal nerve effectively, both in animals and then in humans, and then go back to the experimental setting and dig further into the detail, what's called translational research. We wanted to move from bench to bedside as rapidly as we could. So we didn't want to spend too much time down blind alleys in the laboratory.
Were you looking at the levels of these neuropeptides with and without migraines to see if there was a difference?
Yes. When we realized we could measure the neuropeptides, we then went to look at patients who had migraine and those who didn't have migraine to see if the changes we'd characterized could be examined during the attack.
On a practical level, how do you actually do this?
Well, you have to pitch up to the accident and emergency when people pitch up with migraine, and I would come and take blood during the attack.
What then did you discover about these neuropeptides you were measuring in animal models and humans, both when they did and didn't have a migraine?
We established that in the animal model, there was only one neuropeptide that was released when we activated the pathway, and we established among the many things that we measured in humans during migraine that actually only one neuropeptide was coming from the trigeminal system was increased, and that was calcitonin gene-related peptide, or CGRP.
Now, around this time, a new class of drugs called triptans came on the scene to treat migraine. A lucky coincidence, as you could now test to see what impact these drugs might have on the neuropeptide CGRP that you'd found was present in migraine attacks. So what was it that you discovered?
The triptan would block the release of CGRP, so turn off the attack. So what we were doing was putting the nerve pathways on the map, so to speak, as a possible target for the triptans, which really was not the thinking that developed them at all.
As a scientist, it always bothers me when people say that if something works, that's good enough, even if they don't know how or why. But surely understanding the underlying mechanism does matter.
Oh, absolutely. The triptans were developed with the idea that they had to constrict cranial blood vessels. They weren't developed at all with the idea that you would do anything to a trigeminal nerve or to CGRP. So, as you say, one of the mistakes in research is to think that you really understood something completely. It's iterative.
So a migraine occurs when the trigeminal nerve is activated to produce CGRP. But do we know what triggers the nerve to do this in the first place? In other words, what actually causes the migraine?
There are two schools of thought about what's causing the nerve to be activated. That subtle but profound problem, I don't think, is resolved.
Well, this new understanding of the biology of migraine that you've uncovered, Peter Goseby, triggered a whole new generation of medications for the condition. So before we talk about these new drugs, you did mention triptans earlier, which have been around for some time now. So if they work so well, why is there a need for new medications?
Yeah, and before we say that, let's not just say that I uncovered it. Wouldn't want anyone listening to think that I just rode off solo into the sun solving the problem. Good work gets done with collaboration. And as you say, triptans, why? For a start, they don't work for everybody. And a good percentage will have some side effect. So the triptans have been great for some people, but they certainly don't solve all the problems.
One group of medications that you've been involved in developing are called gepants, which is a great name, by the way. What's novel about gepants? How do they differ from triptans?
Someone was going to call them pants as opposed to gepants before we pointed out that in some cultures, calling something pants is not really an advantage.
I have to say, gepants sounds a bit like sort of some anti-gravity superhero.
It's much cooler.
My gepants.
Yeah, it's much cooler. That's right.
But why? Where does the word come from? Why pants?
All the drugs have to have a stem that links them to the thing that they're doing. The stem name tells you that it's a CGRP receptor antagonist.
So what's novel about them? How do they differ from triptans?
Triptans act on the serotonin system, which is another neurotransmitter involved in migraine, and act by stopping CGRP being released. Gepants act by blocking the effect of CGRP when it is released.
And then, of course, there are monoclonal antibodies too. How are they different?
The monoclonal antibodies we have in clinical practice, some of them will bind to CGRP, so mop it up, you might say, so it can't have an effect. And one of the others sits on the receptor, the CGRP receptor, so that CGRP can't interact with it.
So these new drugs, gepants and monoclonal antibodies, are designed to treat migraine. Do they also prevent them?
Yeah, monoclonal antibodies were designed to prevent migraine. The gepants were designed initially to treat the attacks. What's turned out is that you can also use a gepant for prevention.
I mean, that sounds like very exciting news for a lot of people to have a drug that actually prevents migraines from starting in the first place. Are any of these medications available yet on the NHS?
Yes, three of the monoclonals have been approved by NICE for use on the NHS.
What about your own patients, Peter? You specialise, of course, in treating headache and migraine. So how much are these drugs changing their lives?
There are patients who you can put on a monoclonal for whom it simply completely revolutionises their life. It's extraordinary as a physician when someone says that to you or sends you an email and says, you know, you just completely changed my life. Not for everybody. It's not the answer to everyone's prayer, but even for those who don't, the fact that we've now gotten to a stage with the biology where if you understand something well enough and you start to nail down what's involved, that there is more light that they'll be able to develop even newer medicines. So I think the message is generally very positive.
Well, of course, while you are a doctor, Peter, treating patients, you've, of course, devoted a good chunk of your career to research and to understanding these biological mechanisms behind migraine. Is that, in your view, what medicine should be about?
Medicine should be about making things better for the person in front of you. Medicine is rich in this way. You can do that by just listening. You can do it by making the correct diagnosis. You can do it by getting the treatments right, and you can do it by research. The beauty of medicine is, so long as you're trying to contribute, you'll be doing some good.
Well, Peter, you won the Brain Prize this year, as I mentioned at the start. How did that feel for you?
Well, it was very surprising, actually. I reviewed some work for this Lundbeck Foundation about a month earlier, and when I had this message on my phone to speak to someone at the Lundbeck Foundation, I assumed they were ringing me to tell me that I'd made some scrambly mistake in the work that I'd done for them the month earlier. So I didn't rush to answer the call, it has to be said, because I thought I was in trouble. So I was A, surprised, and I was greatly relieved that I hadn't done anything silly. It was fantastic to share with my colleagues. I think that what's important about it is it puts migraine on the map. You know, I've seen migraine go from a Cinderella topic that was not fit for serious scientific discussion to be a topic that's fit at the top table for serious discussion. And that's great for patients.
I have to ask, for someone who only decided to study medicine to prove a point in an argument with his mother, how do you feel about that spur of the moment decision now?
Oh, it's worked out pretty well for me, I have to say. You know, you make the best of the choices you make, and I'm sure my mother probably would have said the same thing. It's too bad that she died so many years ago that she never really got to see any of the fruits of our little discussion.
Professor Peter Goseby, thank you very much for sharing your life scientific.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening. And thanks to my producer, Beth Eastwood. And if you'd like to listen to other episodes in the series, go to bbcworldservice.com/discovery.